All right, Basil Abu Rub.
Hey,
I finally got you on the show, man. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it's been half of the Corona lifespan.
Fucking Corona, man. I mean, if it wasn't for Corona, I wouldn't have even started this whole thing, to be honest. So I'm kind of glad that Corona happened. If it wasn't for Corona, there's no way I would be sitting here on a podcast having you on. I don't know if you had the chance to see like the previous episodes with Khalid Talhouni.
Yeah.
And I think the one with Basil, sorry, Talal Al-Tabbaa on Bitcoin. Have you seen that one?
No, because at the time, you know, all the way back then, I was not really interested in Bitcoin at all or any of this crypto stuff until recently, actually.
Man, so I don't think anybody has been. I mean, I was dabbling around with this whole thing.
Yeah.
I actually started, I got into it, let's say, 3 years ago when Talal raised his $30 million in an ICO. Which is not exactly like giving out shares. It's giving out coins. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
but I only got into it this year, and what a fucking year it's been, man. Financially, it's like, you know, between trading stocks, trading crypto, and, you know, don't even get me started with the work, company, personally. It's been a fucking crazy year, man, on all fronts.
In a good way.
And a bad way, but like, yeah. in many ways, the bad way.
Yeah, well, so basically, there's a lot more than just podcasting that you started doing after the corona.
What else have I done?
Bitcoin trading, making money, hustling.
Losing a lot of money too. I mean, I have to say, no
You're
joke.
Gambling.
I'm gambling. And then I got to say, like, there's one thing, and I probably have to dedicate a whole episode for this whole thing.
Is about what?
About, like, the underworld of trading and how, you know, compared to a casino, it's like, you know, the God mode and the level, the VIP room of Aria in Vegas should be like a stock trading and a crypto trading room.
Yeah. I mean, I studied finance, right? And I'm not in the finance industry. I've left it. I graduated in 2007, and then the fucking financial crisis hit.
Yeah, man.
You know, what a bad time to to study finance, because that's where the trend was.
Yeah,
you know, the past 20 years since the 90s, there was an explosion in this industry, which led to the financial crisis. So in a way, I am a child of a financial bubble. I went into the education of it.
And I don't know if you got laid off. I got laid off in the financial crisis.
Ah, no, I didn't get laid off. No, that's not one of those. I'm not a Lehman now. Left the office from the building in a box.
This was literally happening. Yeah, you can see them in Wall Street, right?
Yeah.
Not exactly Wall Street, but it was actually for me, ironically, I ended up getting a job with Carney at a higher level, which I wouldn't have gotten to probably if I didn't get laid off, because I wasn't planning to apply outside of my company at the time. So I actually ended up getting a better position a month later, better pay, and smack in the middle of the financial crisis when I've just been fired for the first time in my life, only a year and a half into my career.
Yeah.
So the irony of how sometimes these things can actually blessings in disguise, you know, you don't know what's coming at you. And then before, Corona is a good example of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's the thing. I mean, I was in banking when the financial crisis was happening, and we were a small team in Abu Dhabi managing about 1.2 billion USD.
Assets under management.
So staring at the screen and it's all bleeding red, I felt that. That was my first, I made a lot of money the first year I worked because the financial crisis didn't arrive here until later.
Yeah.
So there was good bonuses. I lived that one year of a finance guy.
The stereotypical life.
Banker, making cash, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm glad I experienced that. And then I'm glad I also experienced the crisis. The biggest crisis in a century, basically.
Yeah.
I experienced it as well.
Yeah.
So I...
Which one hit you harder, on a personal level or... Professionally, I guess we're all getting screwed left, right, and center in both cases.
Yeah.
But which one, did you feel impacted you? I guess I'm going to go ahead and assume Corona, maybe, because of just
the
social distancing and all that.
Yeah, look, man, I think that this, you know, the financial crisis and the Corona are basically the same thing, but just with different feathers, you know? Of course, when the financial crisis hit, we were 23,
Yeah.
You know? Now, at 35, you're 35 as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 36 recently.
We went to school together.
True, we did.
Same grade. Yeah.
We played in the same band.
Now at 35, you've been through a lot more. So, you know, you get a little bit more experience, a little bit more wisdom, you know, as you go along. I think that, you know, we'll be lucky if we can say that, yeah, I've grown wiser,
yeah,
in a way. Some people don't go through that at all, you know. That's why they have these, that's why they have these midlife crises. That, you know, أو بالعربي بيقول لك جهل الأربعين. You know, it usually happens at 45 when the man blows up his entire life, leaves his wife, leaves his kids,
yeah,
goes
yeah.
through a divorce, quits his job, decides to do, you know, follow his dreams, move to the Philippines and, you know, marry a Filipino girl or something.
It's the classic story.
It's the classic Western man, or let's say the classic modern man's story.
And actually,
really.
So one thing I also, specifically on that topic that I recently learned is that most suicides in the US, and which is like, I think, like the epidemic of the pandemic of suicide, let's call it that, because there's a lot of heroin addiction and then a lot of suicides in the US. Most of it are these white men in their 40s, according to Joe Rogan episodes.
That's true. I've read that as well, and it's a fact. I'm pretty sure. If you got a team of fact checkers around,
hey Jamie, pull up this. If this is the Joe Rogan, it'd be like, hey Jamie, pull up the number of statistics of suicides in the U.S. between 2000 and 2020. Kager,
yeah,
you'll never see Kager.
And then his extremely important guest is waiting for the answer to be proven right
or debunked,
or debunked. But usually he's got. Yeah. He's got some pretty quality guests,
that's
you
true.
Know.
That's true.
But yeah, no, the crisis, both of them were both of the same effect on us. But just that, luckily, we are a bit more wise. And one of the things that I luckily went through was this episode of enlightenment, in a way, you know, and it happened. After my 30s, so it enabled me to understand myself better, and I think that one of the most important things in anybody's life is to know thyself, right? There's so many ways you can do it, but the important thing is. For you to go one step or two steps or 10 steps beyond the surface of who you are. And that will enable you to face any kind of crisis, whether it's corona, pandemic, financial crisis, meltdown of the global economy.
Yeah.
You know? And one of the things that that I learned is that there are a few universal truths, a few universal facts that are not just... they're not just shining a light on me personally as Basil, as whatever it is I represent in my life, you know, but on everybody else, you know.
Yeah.
And one of these things is that we are obsessed with control.
Yeah.
We're obsessed with control.
Yeah.
We need to control outcomes. We need to control incomes. We need to control relationships. We need to control our day. We need to control our careers, our money. But most importantly, we want to control outcomes.
Mm.
You know, so when a slap in the face hits you a couple of times, or you know, for some people even more,
yeah,
they eventually I think will come to realize that you know you cannot control everything,
mm-hmm.
and you have to detach yourself. From everything.
Yeah.
It's
kind of like that's what they say, the happiness is expectations minus reality equation, right? So when you try to control things, you set an expectation. And so the more you believe in that expectation to be the objective truth of how things should go, the harder the fall if you don't meet that expectation. Happiness is below zero in that equation, you know?
Yeah.
But this sticks, like, letting go is I mean, we could say, like, we could be sitting here right now and be like, it's easy for us to talk about letting go because, you know, we are a bit privileged compared to people who the anxiety to control things is, you know, is real. Like, making ends meet, like, living check to check, having a big family and all of that. But even there, I think you're right, is that the point is that there's so much you could do when an earthquake can happen, a corona could hit, you see your boss dies and you take his role. Like, anything could happen that could move things around in a way that you didn't expect, regardless of what your situation is in life.
Yeah, yeah. I'm reading a lot of Alan Watts recently, you know, and, you know, if you haven't read any Alan Watts, I think that you should really get into it. What an entertaining, enlightening read. He's a British guy in the 50s, you know. He got really big in the 70s. He was, by the end of his career, he was giving lectures all around the world, especially in California, back in the 70s. But before that, he was basically a pastor, a Christian pastor. And then he got interested in Buddhism and Hinduism as well. And he moved to India and he learned and he moved around the world and he studied indigenous cultures and all that stuff. Mm. And I was listening to one of his lectures and he mentions a story which is actually very, I think, relevant to our situation now. Our situation now in terms of the pandemic or even in terms of our personal lives, you know. People get divorced, people lose family members, people get severely ill. And the story helped me when I was going through a rough time a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a story about a Chinese farmer that owns a bunch of wild horses. And one day, one of the wild horses, the best one he has, escaped, ran away into the forest. And the neighbors came around that evening and they were like, oh, well, isn't that too bad? And the wise Chinese farmer said, maybe. A few days later, the horse comes back with 10 wild horses. He brought 10 back with him. The guy is an alpha male, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's why he's the best. Anyway, he brought the 10 horses back, and the neighbors came around that evening, and they were like, wow, isn't that fabulous? Isn't that fantastic? And the Chinese farmer said, maybe. You know, he did not confirm, he did not deny.
Yeah.
A few days after that, his son broke his leg, fell off one of the horses, the wild ones, while he was trying to tame the new ones that came, and broke his leg. And the neighbors came around that evening and they said, oh, isn't that too bad? And again, the Chinese farmer said, maybe. A few days after that, the Chinese army came to take young men to fight in the war. But they didn't take the son because of his broken leg. So the neighbors came around that evening and they said, wow, isn't that great? And then the Chinese farmer said,
maybe.
So the story really struck with me because there's a universal truth to it. And it's even written in the Quran.
Yeah.
I don't know the ayah correctly, probably, but وَلَعَلَّكُمْ تَكْرَهُونَ شَيْئًا
وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, وَلَعَلَّهُ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ, basically. And they always, you know, they
love that story.
Yeah. So they always say that, especially in our culture, you know, which is funny because sometimes you're talking to like an older person and you know they know nothing about Quran, for example,
but
they know this one.
It's a good one.
Right?
I love it. And
it's
I'm
a
Christian.
Good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is also in the Bible.
Probably,
I've seen it. I've seen it. But I can't remember how it's, you know, how it's said. But, you know, everything is a maybe, really. Everything is a maybe and you cannot attach or label.
Yeah, man.
You cannot label an event in your life as good or bad, and you cannot assign judgment.
Yeah,
Because everything that happens in your life, like the global financial crisis, the pandemic, and all the devastation, the catastrophes that it caused the world and also your personal life, and you probably know people that maybe, you know, got deeply affected. You know, maybe not you, but you know somebody within your second, third degree.
I do. You know we have three of our friends' fathers passed away from Corona, and
I've heard stories.
May they rest in peace. Yeah, it's when it starts to be that close around you, like three fathers of close friends all in the same week or month rather.
Yeah, absolutely. But the solace that you'll find, right? The solace that you'll find when you understand that life does not work linearly.
Yeah.
So in your mind works in a linear way. It's an analytical tool. That's all it does. It calculates. So what we're used to is to understand that there's one door after another door after another door.
Yeah.
So if you open one door, and it's bad news, a bad event, something like that, that means that the door after it is going to be bad, because your mind is a monkey mind.
Yeah.
You know, it needs to expand itself and it break out of its box.
Dude, exactly. And I have to say, like, one thing that happened specifically in Corona, and you were firsthand involved in this, because I came to you, and thank God you were around at the time to give me some advice on it, because, you know, aside of the fact that we've been friends for so long and all that, but you also went through a similar situation. So, but when during the Corona, during the lockdown, you know, the whole thing that you hear about couples, you know, having, you know, the relationships that are already, let's say, going through tough times can get much, much tougher, and even the normal relationships would. And so when I was going through a bit of a tough time, and thank God things are great now with my partner, when I came to you, like wondering, how should I, like, you know, there are certain times when, do I write an email, do I call, do I not call, do I not email? Like, there was all that control that I was trying to look at to fix things. And you never gave me any advice on, you should write that email, you should not write that email. Your only advice was, don't try to control it. Like, let go of the trying to control things, and let whatever happens, and it's going to be good, whatever, like, almost with this level of optimism. And that's exactly what happened, and that's, like, probably
it's not optimism, but carry on.
I had to see it as optimism, because otherwise I would have not been able to control it, to stop controlling it. So in my head, it was like the positive.
It's empowerment.
Yeah.
It's empowerment.
Yeah.
You know, when you let go, when you understand how detachment works, and you start mastering the art of detachment.
Yeah.
You know, It takes a long time. I'm not saying I'm a master of it at all, but
right.
I'm getting to understand it more and more and deeper, which led me into reading a bunch of books on philosophy, and basically that's one of the things, one of the main pillars that they discuss, you know, because detachment is mainly detachment from your ego, right? And that's what happens when, you know, we live in such a material world, right? And you know, the modern man that we are, you know, Western modern sort of, you know, we have such inflated egos. It's ridiculous. And even for Arab men, you know, coming where we come from,
that's a maximum. I mean, the pride.
Our egos are men and women.
Mm.
Are extremely inflated, and that's because we grew up on the concept of control.
Tribalism as well.
It's all a form of control.
That's true.
You know, the tribe, the religion, it's all control. And I'm not saying that it's unique to the Arab man. It's universal, but mainly in the monotheistic religions,
right.
You know, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity.
Yeah.
So... The minute that you start to break away these beliefs that you had, that you thought are your core beliefs, because somebody handed you a piece of paper with those beliefs on them at a young age and told you to believe in them, and you never questioned.
Everybody around you was also believing in them too, right? That's validating.
So that's it. It's everybody is society is basically a form of controlling the individual, right? Where we come from. So we're used to controlling things. We need to have guaranteed outcomes, and we live mainly in our minds. We don't really experience the world We don't experience life. Yeah. We don't experience our bodies, kind of thing. Unless you work, you know, more towards it, because you're always thinking and you're feeling guilty, and you're anxious, you know, yeah, because you want to control something. Guilt is also a form of control, because you want to feel. When you feel guilty, you're basically
trying to change the outcome, or
you're trying to console yourself.
Yeah,
you know, so that you can feel you can feel better and more in control.
Yeah, you know.
But you don't. You fight it. You fight so many feelings.
But there's one thing, because there's one form of control that I was curious to kind of understand. So I came across this term called equanimity when I started getting into like mindfulness, and I never actually got properly into mindfulness, but that was one thing that caught my attention. So equanimity is kind of like it's probably not the exact accurate definition, but something about like trying not to control things and being indifferent to the kind of shit that goes around in your life and what you can control and what you can't. And it was like discussed that people should aim to become equanimous, or equanimity should be the mode of operation basically. And I just struggle to understand how it goes hand in hand with things like aspiration and drive and this emotion to change the world and improve the world, which requires a little bit of, I got to control this, or I got to achieve this. You know, there's no champion in sports or an entrepreneur that didn't get anxious. And it's because of that drive and that kind of need to control that they achieved great things. So I'm actually constantly talking to people who are in this form of like mindfulness or healing or whatever it is. Try to understand how to reconcile these two. How can you still be driven? Hope the dog is not like, is he cool?
Yes.
Yeah. He shows up every now and then.
Beautiful. See if you can get love him. That. I love this. I love this kid.
He's in the logo. I don't know if you can. Well, he's gone now. Here he is. You can see his nose.
Yeah, we're chilling.
Yeah, so I mean, I have no idea how can a person both be driven and aspirational and do, like, you know what I mean, and still not be willing not to control things. Like, have you ever thought about that? Can you reconcile these two? And
yeah. I think I can, and the simple one word answer for that, but it's, you know, you can write volumes on it, is authenticity.
Mm.
This is what it is, because, you know, if you look at the giants and the greats, as you mentioned, you know, and for some reason, Michael Jordan popped up.
Sure.
Did you mention Michael Jordan?
No, but he's definitely on top of that list. Yeah.
And yesterday I was watching a Netflix documentary, The Defiant Ones.
Yeah.
It's a 4-part documentary about Jimmy Iovine, the producer in the 70s, who also teamed up with Dr. Dre.
Oh, I don't know.
And there was who's also the rise of Dr. Dre is an insane story.
Yeah.
And then they made Beats, the headphones.
Oh, okay.
And they sold it for $3 billion to Apple.
Yeah.
You know, the world's first hip hop artist billionaire that created. So the documentary is about that, and beyond the smoking the joints and, like, you know, banging them hoes and shit like that, and getting jailed by the police.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hard work, man.
Yeah.
A lot of hard work. It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. And these people, just like Steve Jobs, you know, I'm talking about the legends.
Right.
The top 100 of humanity, or at least modern humanity.
Yeah.
Those guys were living their authentic selves,
right,
and that's what allowed them to become this successful. You know, when you are trying to copy someone else and not live according to your authentic self, which takes a lot of time. Like we said, know thyself. Mm. It's a lifelong process, right? But we don't go through that exercise, especially in our culture.
Yeah.
Because we are meant to grow up in a certain way, and there are milestones in our lives that we have to hit, and then you die.
Yeah, so you're not living your true self in that sense. And when you try to control things, then you're going to get slapped in the face.
Well, I mean, no, when you're trying to control things, then and things don't go your way, you start throwing your toys out of the crib.
Yeah, you throw a tantrum.
Right, throw a tantrum. You're angry. You're jealous. You're envious. You're you're anxious. Right. But when you start understanding your authentic self, right? Yeah. And then going back to your question, I mean, I'm building up to that ambition. How do you reconcile that, you know? detachment and ambition.
Yeah.
Right? But when you learn how to live according to your authentic self, according who you truly, truly are at the core, right? At the core, not what you think you are.
Yeah.
Not what you think you should be.
Yeah.
Doctor, muhandis, muhami. Inshallah, abad man shufu uladak, you know? this is what categorizes the Arab life, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You graduate from high school, abad al-shahad al-kibire. You know, we look forward to your university graduation. Everybody tells you, society. Then when you graduate from the big from the big university, they're like, عقبال ما نفرح بعرسك. Yeah. You know, you graduated. Now we want to dance at your wedding.
Oh, من هلا الأعلى. If you wanted to go do your PhD.
Oh yeah, or that, yeah. And then at the wedding, they come and tell you, عقبال ما نشوف أولادك.
Yeah.
You know, and when you have a kid, they say when he graduates from high school. You see the pattern here? It's a bit fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Sorry. By the way, the dog literally knocked off the camera.
He's the man.
Lewis, he's gone now. And so yeah, it's. But I think it's. I mean, I think we. I would rather have my. The wishes that come my way be about getting degrees and all that, but like haram, women have it bad in the Arab world with the whole marriage thing, you know, like,
yeah,
the,
man,
like
it's horrible,
you know, there's an actual like it almost becomes, you know, ingrained in you, disappointment to your family if you're not getting married. But fortunately it's getting better, by the way. Do you think it's still the way?
It's not getting any better. It's not getting any better.
So, like, do you think that we still live in a time when, like, a woman might feel that maybe to her parents a disappointment that up until now she hasn't gotten married, or she might be, like, a burden on her parents? Like, that's how they would be seen at one point in history. Like, women, unmarried women in a family are, like you know, a burden, right? I mean, do you think we still have that? I mean, I'm talking about Jordan and like, more West Amman here, and I'm talking, like, a little bit of our... Because if it's still there in our kind of like background, then it's a problem. Because like then
absolutely.
I mean, it's a problem anyway. Even if it's still there everywhere, but if it's so bad that it's still like that for us, then it's really a big problem.
How many times do you hear about, let's say, a rich Muslim family and a rich Christian family, two children want to marry each other and they don't allow it?
Yeah, well, that's
yeah. That's I mean it, yeah. If the question is, if we value the authentic self, the authentic individual, right, we will not have these issues.
Yeah,
you know. Of course, religion is important. I'm not saying let's go have orgies every weekend, and you know it's all good, and let's steal, let's do crime or whatever. You know, it's still, shame is important.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But because we have all those levels of control,
yeah.
Then the person cannot become who he wants to become, right? And if he can't become who he wants to become, then he becomes someone else,
right?
Right. So he's trying to be a good banker.
Yeah.
He's trying to be a good businessman.
Yeah.
He's trying to be a good engineer. But deep down inside, maybe he doesn't give a fuck about engineering.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe he wanted to play music or do acting or write, you know, or become a journalist.
And he or she never managed to even explore that because they never even had the capacity to explore it.
Exactly. But they always go about their lives feeling like there's something missing.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we have the luxury being, you know, we went to college in a foreign place. A lot of us did not come back to Amman.
Sure.
To work because we have access to the world, so we are privileged in that way, because it allowed us to see the world differently. Had we stayed in Amman, we would be a shit show.
Sure.
You know, I mean, no offense to anybody who stayed in Amman. I'm sure they grew in their own fantastic ways. I'm not saying that this is the way to get out of Amman. This is not the message that I'm sending.
Right.
The message that I'm sending is that wherever you live, you need to understand yourself.
Sure.
And you need to understand who you are at an authentic level so that you understand what you love.
Yeah.
So you understand what you're interested in. So you understand the kind of woman, for example, for men or men for men. Or who knows, man?
Yeah.
Like, you need to understand what kind of partner attracts you so that you can eventually make the huge decision of getting married, for example. That's an insanely complex decision.
Yeah, not the fact that they just come from a certain family or they have a
certain... These are shortcuts.
Yeah.
These are shortcuts handed down to you because this is al-urf, or what they call the common wisdom, you know. We've thought about it before, so you don't have to think about it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just do it, you know. We're handing you the knowledge. No, you know, this is not the time for conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, if we want to live a full life, especially in the shit that's happening right now, you know.
And this whole thing about living your true self, like, it goes both ways, right? So either you're living down a path that you did not choose for yourself or that was dictated for you and somehow you got hijacked into it and you never got to explore who you really are. And that's one miserable way of living your life, which is we've all somehow, one way or another, by the way, have experienced. Some managed to might escape of it. Others are still stuck in it one way or another. But, you know, nobody's, I think, completely liberated from having experienced that.
Not even close.
But then the second version of that, which also leads to the same outcome of ingenuity in your life, is when, for whatever reason, you turn out to be good at one thing, and you don't even like it, but you're good at it, right? And it's almost like you're built for this, but you don't even like it. And that causes like imposter syndrome where you might start to question why you're even successful at something that can seem easy to you. And that you're not even deserving of the success you might be getting from it because you don't even, you know, you must like it at some level, or using it as a mean for, you know, other feelings that you might be trying to experience, you know, success and so on. But at some level, you either don't feel like you deserve that success or that you're not even built for this, or you want to do something else, but you're good at what you're doing. And imposter syndrome, like, is a real thing.
Absolutely.
And this is a form of ingenuity because you're not living what you are controlling yourself to live, but also it doesn't seem to click with what you feel is your true self. You know what I mean?
Yeah, look... Both.
We didn't choose, by the way, so can we choose? Because I think this is a traditional thing for the show.
Thank you, Yazan, for this delicious cucumber water.
This apple cider. Sorry, you were saying?
Both ways. Whether you are really good at something, but you don't feel like you deserve it because it came so easy to you, which is a very rare thing, you know? We're talking professionally, but by the way, it can apply to any kind of existence. Like, yeah, even being a mother or a father, you know, you need to parent your children authentically.
Yeah,
basically. But applying to ambition, both require a lot of hard work.
Sure.
But you know, it's not like if you take the path of doing what you love, it's gonna all come easy. You need to work hard. As hard, but the emotional turmoil that you go through is not as bad, you know, because on you know, when you're doing something that you don't want to do, you know, because of one reason or another, even those people like the imposter syndrome people, you know, why are they trapped in that label? Like if you're you know, Kurt Cobain and he feels like an imposter because he doesn't enjoy the music and he's exploding of fame, he could just leave. But
something about how he led,
he's in a prison of his own mind, right? And no wonder the band is called Nirvana, which is enlightenment in Buddhism. You know, this is the basically state where you reach nirvana is when you are liberated and with Kurt Cobain, he was a bit he could not escape that role of Kurt Cobain from Nirvana, right? As long as we know how to escape the prison of our minds, basically, that's when just Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, you said you recently... Hold on, I had to go get some water. You said that you recently also read up about the suicide, the suicide letter of Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, I did. I also need to get some water. Hold on.
So, that's one thing that I, you know, every time I wonder about this 27 Club, right? All these artists that were successful and were, was it 27 years old for some reason, that's when they all kill themselves. So Amy Winehouse, Jimi Hendrix. But even like Robin Williams, who is who would never strike me as someone that would be miserable enough or depressed to kill himself. Like, you know how much fucking guts it takes to like shoot yourself or, I don't know, throw, like, jump off a cliff or whatever. Every person has a different poison. And usually it's the most, like a lot of those successful people. The other day I read about this 22-year-old girl from Stanford, engineering student, I think silver medalist, Olympics, 22 years old, man. Like how long, how much has this girl seen to have accumulated enough depression from her success to kill herself? And she, all she's experienced is success, you know, at 22 years old and still killed herself.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling to us because when we look at, you know, this poor soul from Stanford or Kurt Cobain or Robin Williams, they all had success. Even Robin Williams was a comedian. Kurt Cobain inspired people. He changed so many lives, you know. Even though they had all the success in the world, they had all the love in the world even, they still feel lost. And that's because, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for addiction and genetic depression, you know, from like, it runs in the family kind of thing.
Predisposition.
But, yeah. There are definitely biological factors as well as, you know, you're more prone to depression, you're more prone to addiction, alcoholism, all that stuff. We sometimes don't really check with ourselves what is in our hearts, kind of thing.
Yeah,
we just experience a lot of trauma. We have, you know, our own depressed states, right? We all do, all of us. You know, that's why we're a little bit. Anxious.
Yeah.
We're anxious people,
yeah.
Right? And this is not normal. If you can try to understand why you get anxious and try to understand how you can calm yourself down, you know? How can you open your heart basically to receive life rather than fight with it? Then you go back to the idea of detachment.
But so here's the thing about finding your genuine self, which as you said, we're all on this journey one way or another. But like today, I'm 36 years old, and I can safely say, can you hear the birds, by the way? They're gone now. I think I should close the door.
I like the birds.
Yeah, let's keep the birds. I'm 36 years old. Thankfully, I've had a good professional life, tried starting companies, got employed. And I don't know if I had all the money in the world and all the time in the world, and I at least have all the time in the world, but even if I did have all the money in the world, I wouldn't know what I would do with my life. Like, it doesn't come at me so obviously. Like, you know, oh, if only I was just like finally retired, like I can now do this. I don't know what this is. And I don't even know how to find it because I really try to search for it. This podcast was meant to be maybe this type thing, not like I want to do this, you know. So try it out and see if it works.
Yeah.
And it's good, but I don't know if yet it's like, oh, yes, finally I found my purpose or whatever it is that you could
describe. Yeah, well here's the silver lining, you know. Here's the positive message out of all of this, you know, because I feel like the past 5 minutes we became a little bit dark, you know.
Yeah, it's brightened up a little bit.
and this is the actual point, going back to the Chinese farmer who kept saying maybe. You know, you have to just quit controlling the outcomes and understand that life is not running in a linear pattern.
Yeah.
Right. Basically, there is no way you can tell if what even if it's the most terrible thing that could happen to you, you know, you get cancer, for example.
Yeah.
You know, I'm dating a cancer survivor. She's a beautiful soul, amazing girl, Luz.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's a breast cancer survivor, and you know, she got it at 30 something, 31.
Shit.
You know what I mean? So when you get to love somebody like that, also it gives you a perspective at the heart level, not at the mind level, where you understand her story and you say, ah, haram, and you move on with your life.
Yeah.
You get involved, you know, you understand.
So what are some of the things that, like, if you can share some of it?
Basically, when you get the most, the most wretched news a person can get,
right,
at our age, 36,
sure,
right, you have cancer, you're gonna flip the fuck out.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's horrible, it's wretched, it's evil, even, you know. And it takes you a while, and these are usually the seven stages of rage or anger, denial, anger, you know.
And that's whether you're gonna die or not gonna die.
Even no, it's not. You know, it's usually the first thing that we think about, probably when you receive such bad news, is how can I fight it?
Yeah.
Right. So that's how our brain is built. We will not think, I'm gonna die.
Yeah.
That's not even a possibility.
Yeah.
In your mind, you get angry, you have rage, you deny, you're coping, right? Yeah. But we fail to see the big
picture. Like, the doctor is a dick and he's like, you have cancer, and like, okay, how can we fight it? He's like, I also forgot to mention you have like 3 months to live, and like, there's no, it's like a really asshole doctor who is like, step by step.
Yeah. I mean, look. Terminal cancer is a different story, but you know, we for the 98% other shit, like I lost my job, I got divorced, I have breast cancer, you know, there, even somebody passed away, someone really close to me, whatever it is, I lost a leg. You think that your life is gonna be shit, basically, for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You don't understand that this actual incident is going to make you a better human being.
Yeah.
Right? And sometimes, yeah, we left, yeah.
Yeah, go on, go on. So.
And sometimes we forget to look at the bigger picture in that way, you know? For example, I got divorced a couple of years back. And that was one of the milestones of my life that really changed me in a positive way. But when I was going through it, I thought that I was scared. You know, I thought that my life is gonna be, you know, changed to the worst. You know, I couldn't see in my mind how this event could be
a positive thing
in the long term, right? Yeah. And by long term, I mean not next week or in a couple of months. I mean, in a couple of years, you know, that's an acceptable time frame to understand the benefits of something bad that happens to you now.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, because it takes 2 years to really get over the trauma. But if you need to understand how to deal with it, you know, and for me, it was an opportunity first to understand what happened, analyze everything that went wrong. And by analyzing it, I'm not saying blaming it on whatever external circumstance, like the pandemic hit, you know, because I also almost lost my business in the pandemic. So I can relate to that also in that parallel, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, regardless of those two, pandemic or a divorce, you start to analyze what went wrong inside of you.
Yeah.
What? Because you are basically, nothing happens to you. Life does not happen to you.
Yeah.
You know, that's a cliche thing to say. Life happens to you, as if we have no control over it. The way we can control life is life happens through us, not to us.
Yeah.
You know. So the way to control that is to understand how what led you up to the divorce, for example?
Mm.
Or how you currently feel about the pandemic? What led you to reach that point on a as yourself on a personality level, for example?
Yeah.
You know, things that you've been maybe overlooking, right? Over the past 10 years, I wasn't happy in running my business. I wasn't happy, even to a certain extent, living in Dubai, because I wasn't able to enjoy it according to how I want to enjoy it. I was fighting it, right?
Yeah.
And I realized that the whole time, I was basically not really living on an authentic level. I thought I had to become an entrepreneur. I thought I had to make a lot of money. And I also thought that I had to marry at the age of 30, 31, someone close to my culture, someone who is, you know, they have criteria, like a fucking checklist.
Yeah.
Right? I've realized all of that, and I've realized that I've been living according to a checklist all my life. And by the way, I've had a very liberated, coming of age, teenagehood and university experience. I was not controlled by my parents or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was controlled by my own mind.
You found yourself following some form of recipe.
Because I never really delved down into who I am really as a person. You know, I'm sure that very few of us have actually grabbed a pen and a paper, right? Sat down in one of those nights where we feel completely lost. And what we tend to do is maybe drink, maybe gossip, maybe go out in fit of rage, maybe break stuff, you know. But you know, all of these tough times that we had when you actually literally wanted to break the glass against the wall and break and smash the mirror.
Yeah,
you know, these are opportunities for us to sit down and grab a pen and a paper. And reflect on why is this happening deeply, really, why? Why do I feel like I have to continue the job that I hate and it's making me miserable for so many years? Why am I not exploiting my talents? Because I have a good ear. I can hear music.
Yeah.
I like to converse, like how you do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? How come I did not invest in more time in those things that make me happy, really happy, instead of going to work, coming back, ordering Deliveroo, watching Netflix, sleeping, next day is the same thing, and then the weekend you go out and get completely fucking hammered, you know, and you do that for so long.
You don't even leave yourself the capacity to have that exercise, whether literally grabbing a paper or just doing it mentally, because you are going from one busy work day to the other, to a totally drunk night out, and before you know it, when have you even had and any chance you might have, maybe you're taking a shit or you're showering, and maybe this is when you think about these things. You're probably on your phone or listening to music, or there's constant kind of a hijacking of a capacity to even just to think. But here's what's even worse: is that a lot of people try to think and find answers, and they might even find themselves spending too much time trying to figure this out, and they only dig deeper into the same hole. For example, somebody that's already in a job that they don't like, and they think that the problem is that they need a promotion or they need to change companies, and the framework of the thinking itself is fundamentally wrong, because they're still looking at what they should do through the eyes of their society or whatever it is they must have been indoctrinated in. And so, you know, even the transformational idea that what if it's not another job in this industry? What if it's a totally different job, or career altogether? Or, that kind of thinking is not even part of the consideration. So some people don't even get the chance to really consider what's genuine for themselves, despite spending a lot of time thinking about it and spending a lot of time trying to get that thing that they think they want. And that's why they end up living a miserable life all their lives, because they just went from one shitty company to another shitty company. And for it took them 30 years to realize, fuck corporate bullshit. If that's, let's say for some people, that's not for them, you know?
Yeah.
It is for most people, and it's there's nothing wrong with it. But for somebody who doesn't want to work in a 9-to-6 on the desk type thing, and for whatever reason, they think the problem is that they are 10% underpaid, or that their company is not appreciating them enough, and they need to change companies. And they're like 20 years later, like, oh, fuck, it's like same shit, different place, different day, you know?
Yeah.
Like, really the importance of being able to figure out as early as possible, and it's okay if it needs to take time, to get that maturity and wisdom, the framework by which you're going to have that exercise done, right? Like, what, like defining what, you know, before you just jump right into thinking it's about a raise or about changing a company or divorcing and finding a different partner. Because like a lot of people, this is, for example, when it comes to divorce and or relationships, it's usually the whole like, well, if that partner is not X, Y, and Z, divorce, find X, Y, and Z. And like, that's probably not the issue here. You know, like the issue is not that, because like, you know, you like some things about that partner, you're not going to find it in the other partner. And if you're going to just try to, you know, check boxes, as you said, you're going to just keep on going from one to the other and you're going to die the trying, you know?
Yeah. عقبال التخريج.
Yeah.
عقبال الأولاد.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. That's the thing when I said grab a pen and paper.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just smoking a pack of cigarettes on the balcony and just looking into the sky.
Yeah.
You know, you need to write down your thoughts because I read somewhere that really struck me and it stuck with me. The benefit of journaling is that it allows you to explore the thought behind the thought. Without journaling, you don't write down the initial thought and then discover and then keep writing and then get to the next thought. You know, I felt this way. This is where we stop usually when we think.
Yeah.
I feel this way. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, but when you journal, because of the linguistic requirements and the way that your mind is attached to, you know, what you want to speak, you have to translate into a writing type.
Right.
It makes things logical a little bit, and also you explore the thoughts behind the thoughts. You know, that's why when we think, we just stop at a certain place, or we don't remember the next day what we thought about, because thoughts are fleeting. Yeah. They come and go, and you can't, if you don't capture them, writing it down, even if it's a great idea, by the way, it doesn't have to be like, why is my life like this? You know, where have I gone wrong? Sometimes you have a problem at work, for example.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, you're stuck in a job that you don't like and you're frustrated with your boss. You know, usually that's you go back home and you're like, ugh, my boss pissed me off. You pour a drink and you forget about it, you know? But if you actually don't forget about it and you don't pour a drink, you come back home, you sit down, you make a cup of tea, or even you have a whiskey, whatever, and you start writing it down instead of trying to forget about it by listening to some music or watching Netflix, you may very well get to at the bottom of the page, by the time you're done with one page writing, you might get to the bottom of things.
Yeah.
You might get to that this is not just about what your boss did today. This is about you not fulfilling your dream of being your own boss.
Right.
And exploring that dream that you always had. Not out of, by the way, not that setting up a business is everybody's dream,
sure,
right? But we are so consumed in that culture,
right? Yeah.
Right. It's we admire people that are billionaires. We celebrate them.
Sure.
Success equals money in the time, you know. So
yeah.
our mentality is extremely distorted. But also, when you journal about this, then maybe you'll get to the point where you understand that chasing money all your life, chasing clients, chasing invoices, closing sales, closing deals,
yeah,
making clients happy, or else you're going to lose the account, or you might lose your business, you know, might run out of cash, for example. All of these things are you're doing their challenges, but also you're doing them not because you want to. Deep down inside, not because this is who you are, but because you have to. It's imposed that it's imposed on you. So maybe at the end of the bottom of the page, you will get a little bit closer to enlightenment in a way that makes sense to you at the core.
And you're gonna have to read that too. I mean, like when you first advised me to journal, and I've never actually journaled before, you told me to do it, and it was fucking incredible. It was like amazing for somebody like me who's usually very impulsive and fast and doesn't give himself enough time to think about things. writing it down, and I'm typing like as fast as I would be thinking at that point. So I'm not even thinking. I might as well just be thinking at this point. But then after I was done, you know, reading it over again, and it does two things, right? It gives you time to like now process all these thoughts that were just jumbled up in your thought, in your head, and you're looking at it and you're like, and then you're kind of repeating that story you just wrote to yourself, and then you're reading it, and it's, you kind of, now you're no longer yourself. You're not the author anymore. You're basically the reader, and it's somebody's biography, and you're like, now you're taking an objective assessment of it, right? So you separate yourself from the person. This is how it felt for me. And this is what gave me some composure to come to some insights or enlightenment or even in action, as one of the decisions that I should be taking is in action, right? In action in and of itself is a path you want to take when you're trying to kind of figure things out. In action, right? Like, I'm going to just not act.
And it's more difficult.
Right.
It's more difficult than action.
Oh, of course.
Because inaction is way more difficult than...
Because it's lack of control, right? You're saying that you tend to control things, and inaction is immediately just trying to not control.
Yeah, but it takes a lot of self-control to control
100%
inaction.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to be in control of.
Yeah.
We need to be in control of ourselves, not in control of the external world, because it's so complex out there.
Yeah.
And you are complex inside. At least you have a better chance at understanding who you are in relation to the world, as opposed to a separate entity to the world, where you are trying to control the outside world versus I am a part of everything that's happening.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Aside from my emotions and how I feel, it's okay. Like it, you know, shit happens, right? But
And
you know something? You know that cliche, non-authentic advice.
Okay, go on.
In 5 years, none of this is gonna matter, right? They say that in 5 years, none of this is gonna matter. Why do people say that? You think they're trying to tell you that. What's happening to you right now, that something tough, you know, a divorce or cancer, they tell you that none of this is going to matter in 5 years? Like what? Like it never happened? That's bullshit, honestly. Because in 5 years after this event happened to you, it's going to matter, but it's going to matter on a personal level because you've grown, and growing is one of the hardest things that you can do as a human being. It's not about your promotions. It's not about your job. It's not about your career. It's not about your business. You know, it's about your growth.
Yeah.
Really. And that's why journaling is important. Reading books as much as you can versus consuming external
sound bites,
you know, sound bites, Netflix, like highly engineered things to give you dopamine like crazy, social media. Instead, you know, reading the books, being still, enjoying nature, things like that to help you connect with yourself.
Yeah, I want to actually, the whole nature thing is specifically, I want to talk about kind of facilitated purpose seeking. And so basically, let me explain what I mean. So we can today try to discover our genuine selves through all these kind of give yourself the time, the capacity. Don't live within the kind of indoctrination or path that's been, you know, there's a lot of kind of more passive ways, let's say. I'm going to call them passive, relatively speaking, because I'm going to compare them to like taking ayahuasca or some sort of psychedelics to help you find these things. I haven't, like, I've dabbled around with psychedelics, not yet with ayahuasca, but with everything else, like so. Acid, mushrooms, well, mainly these two, as far as psychedelics are concerned. But a lot of friends of mine are, and let me just make it very, like, right off the bat, that I did see the impact of them helping you find, you know, compassion or feelings of kind of resolution to certain issues. Thinking about things in a certain way, but maybe not giving you full-on answers to questions, you know, but just... there is a lot of that there. But with ayahuasca, and I haven't done that yet, but I have a lot of friends who did, it seems to be transformational. Like, but then you see them living their lives, right? And you see the change, but it's also not as transformational. So they're still doing what they're doing. They just feel better as people. Like, they feel better, about their lives and about, they're just calmer. They're less egoistic, so that's good. There's not as much ego. There's not as much control. There's more acceptance to the current life, but not so much, I figured out I got to do something else with my life. And that's pretty interesting, because that's basically almost like saying you are where you are, combination of your choices in life with what, you know, with the dice that life that you threw when you were born, like that they were thrown when you were born for you. And rather than changing it, just accept it. Don't let your ego, that's probably trying to change it, to make you do things that and in most cases you're going to regret them. Basically, long story short, is what I'm trying to say is I want to actually try ayahuasca, because I personally could use a little bit of that in my current personal journey of finding.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've also, psychedelics generally are known to heal.
Right.
And in the medical journals now, they're probably publishing or going to publish a lot of research that has resumed, which was paused in the 70s because of political reasons, and now it's resuming. And a lot of them are finding out, and they're going to write, that it helps with moderate depression.
Or what depression?
Moderate depression.
Oh, okay.
or PTSD, post-traumatic syndrome.
Yeah.
These findings are basically scientific jargon for they help heal people.
Right.
And one of the things that they actually do, aside from helping you know yourself, is also understand how the world is working. Because when you start experiencing those types of psychedelics and having those experiences generally, you start seeing the world differently. So you don't need to be high in order to, you can be completely sober, living day-to-day life, but having witnessed these enlightening moments, they will assist you in living your day-to-day life as a human being, not as a corporate drone or as a parent, or as somebody without a job, or somebody with difficulty going on. You start understanding that life is happening, and you are exactly where you need to be at this particular moment, because it's gonna open new doors that you cannot possibly imagine. There's another story by Alan Watts. It's not a story, it's more of a dialogue. And he basically invites his audience to, imagine that you dream a dream. And in the dream, you are in control of everything, almost like you're like God, it's a marvelous dream, you can do whatever you want and you're living it. But then after a few, a few dreams like that, a lot actually, you're going to say, give me something else. Surprise me.
Yeah.
I want a surprise. I'll surprise me a little bit. And you have those kinds of dreams, and you get surprised and you go, wow, that's really amazing. I want more of that. And eventually you're going to keep wanting more and more surprises, to the point where your dreams are entirely unpredictable. And at that stage, you become who you are.
Ah, wow. That's beautiful.
Right? You are literally living the dream of a god. But the god chose to go to sleep and have a dream where he doesn't know what's going to happen. And you are dreaming that dream.
Yeah, and I think,
it means that being a human being.
Yeah.
I'm not just saying fluffy furry shit,
Yeah.
But being a human being means that you need to surrender.
Yeah.
To the world, but also live authentically, which means that aside from eating and putting food on the table and all that stuff, you know, the way that you function in this world has to be according to who you are, not according what you should be. So yeah. Your question should be not what I ought to do. It should be what I want to do.
Yeah, but let's talk about that for a second, man. Because, I mean, I just can't fucking figure out what that is. When I come to think about this question, I come to two categories of answers. Either there are degenerate activities that, when I say degenerate, I mean like they satisfy kind of like... okay, go ahead. All right, I'm going to talk for the next couple of minutes about why I can't find my answer. Bathroom break for Basil. Go ahead, you can run. You're good.
I can hear you.
Oh yeah, no worries. So, I don't think we've ever had a guest go to a bathroom in the middle of a live stream, but we're going to do this. So whenever I try to think about the things that I would want to do because it's my purpose or it's my genuine self, I come to two types of answers. The hedonistic, impulsive, gives you instant pleasure and instant gratification type of things, right? For example, I like to play poker, party, go to Burning Man. I mean, if I could live life like that, a Dan Bilzerian life minus fucking the hot chicks as he does, because I'm in a relationship. But anyway, my point is, that's one category of answers. The second one is a bunch of purposeful, a list of things that I would consider purposeful or impactful, or I think I need to do them or want to do them, like entrepreneurs. Did you hear anything I said? Not so much?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. So I heard something.
When I think about what I want to do, I'm going to try to recap.
The interesting thing is how is, yes, I'm going to recap all of this in a very precise way and entertaining way.
I'm going to try to be as brief as possible.
That's the challenge, you know.
When I think about what I should do in my life, because that's what I want to do, my purpose in life, or what I should be doing genuinely, it's either two types of paths. One is the hedonistic instant gratification one. If I could live life playing poker and going to Burning Man and whatever, these are the examples I was giving. That's one way of saying that's my genuine self. These are the things that I like to do: have sex, drink, fucking party, go to Tulum, whatever. This is one that I call it the Dan Bilzerian life. I was saying minus,
yeah.
I was saying minus fucking all the hot chicks because I'm in a relationship. But otherwise, yeah, totally. Yeah. Like guns and poker and one path, right? Second path of how I should.
He went bankrupt, though.
Did he?
Yeah, he's on the run now.
Oh, but his company. He's still gonna be fine, I think. Second path is all these kind of, then it's like this blue sky thinking of purpose and impact and, all right, well, I started this company, what about that company? Or I took this job, what about that job? And there I struggle because, like, you know, and I'm sure it's not as simple as live hedonistically or live with some form of kind of purpose and a thoughtful life of some sort. Can't figure out that second one. It doesn't come to me naturally. And that's what I'm hoping that I can, you know, and I'm sure I'm not expecting you to come and give me the answer now, but it would be nice if you can chime in on it with your own experience and your own thoughts on it. When you say people should live within a genuine life, not based on how it's dictated for them, do you have any form of framework, or it's the toughest question in the world? Books have been written on it and still nobody has a clear answer. So maybe what is the answer that you have on how you should approach a question of how you should live or what you should be doing genuinely and living your genuine life? Have you? What's the framework you apply?
I think first thing is that you were saying vices and
hedonism,
but you mentioned vices.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
You said gambling, you said drinking, you said banging girls,
right?
All that stuff. These are things that. I mean, first of all, you should not label them because, you know, even if you read stories or articles or pieces written by ex-heroin junkies, some of them, quite a few of them actually, they say that heroin was the best thing that ever happened to them, right? Because of having to recover from it and that turning their lives around, not because it's an amazing high.
For a second, I was like, maybe you can justify that too, because like I'm not entirely unsure that that's entirely off the, you know, if I can live my life having fun and I know it's a bad answer, but you know what I mean? Like maybe there's on a philosophical level room for a path of saying hedonism, you know, live to eat, don't eat to live type, you know, like there is maybe something there.
No, but no, but the thing is what you're insinuating, let's say, or what you're perhaps not, you're not aware that you're getting into is that if we are left to our own devices, what I hear you say, if we're left to our own devices, that means that we are going to become animals. Yes, we are prone to addictions, but these are the addictions that are considered vices. But believe me, we are addicted to way more than just alcohol, nicotine, drugs. We are addicted to jealousy. We're addicted to envy. We're addicted to rage. We're addicted to wealth. Anxiety. These things, yeah. Wealth and all these things,
yeah.
and the blind pursuit of all of these things, because we think that we should, they're creating a lot of these toxic feelings and emotions and states and experiences which we become addicted to.
Sure.
For example, I mean, if I ask you a question, what is your emotional home? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Describe your emotional home. Where do you emotionally live on a day-to-day basis? We all have homes, right? We all have spaces. What is your emotional space? How can you describe it?
It's a tough one.
It's a tough one, right? And I never really delved into that until, you know, recently, a few years ago.
It definitely has components of family in it, right? Like some form of like emotional home is the presence of some form of family, which is either my first degree family, like with my parents or with my partner, or you know.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay,
sorry,
okay.
But
yeah, clarify. That's fine.
The emotional home, not the place or the space where you experience emotions. It's the emotion where you live in.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So I've realized that all my life I've maintained an emotional home which I can describe as guilt. And I'm sure a lot of us experience that. It's a common feeling. But there are others that don't experience guilt. You know, they don't feel bad all the time. They're not so nostalgic. You know, they're not so emotional, you know.
What are you guilty about?
It's a default mode of the way your brain feels, the way that your brain makes you feel, you know. And for me, it's generally guilt. The first thing that I wake up and I think about as an emotion, I think about other things, you know, but as an emotion is if I'm a little bit unstable. Let's say I'm waking up hungover. Or I'm waking up a little tired, I didn't sleep well, I was upset, whatever it is. The first thing that I think about emotionally is guilt. Like, oh, what did I do? What did I do yesterday or last week or the month before or the year before that I'm not proud about? And I feel guilty about it.
Wow, that's right? So true, by the way.
Yeah, you can identify 100%, with that. I'm sure.
It almost starts to feel like you do things for the sake of validating them from a lens of guilt afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, when I talk about my vices, I seem to do, for example, a level of, like, drinking. Okay, let's say drinking too much, and you're never, it's not like a workout. Like, with a workout, you never, like, after the workout being like, what the fuck, that was workout? I wish I never did that workout. Like, you're never going to go like that about a workout. Like, never. There's no workout where you're going to regret it after. But, like, with alcohol...
Wait. Yeah. Why?
No, I'm just saying you always feel good after every workout.
I know that. Yeah. I know that. But this is the surface thought.
Okay.
But wait until one day you're out with your friends, and this is a true story, happened to me.
Okay.
And we go out to play football, which is a great workout. I go to the gym. I like to swim as well.
Sure.
When my friend called me and was like, you know, we need a player. Are you interested? Even though I'm not I don't really regularly do this football stuff. I said, yeah, sure. It'd be a great workout. And I ended up being a goalie. Okay. And I was a great goalkeeper. I saved a lot of shots. One of them hit me directly in the hand like that. Okay, it was a 90-degree angle, and it was like shot. It was a striker, yeah. You know,
Captain Rabih.
Captain Rabih style. Mahada.
Julian.
And it hit my it hit my finger, and look what happened to it.
Oh wow! All right.
Okay. See. Right. So.
To talk about your Chinese farmer story, but maybe this finger with this angle now can be used in a way that can, you know, how many people can bend their finger like that? And think about all the things you could do with it with a finger with this kind of angle.
Absolutely.
I can think of one.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the point is, you can get regret going to the gym if you injure yourself, and then you ask yourself a question, you know.
Yeah, but sorry, let me clarify what I'm saying. So you can go to the. There are things that are generally things that you're going to feel good after when you potentially go about them. Like, oh, I don't want to do this, but when you do them, you're going to always be like, oh, I'm glad I did it. Like a workout generally is a feeling like I'm glad I pushed myself to work out. Okay,
a rule of thumb type of thing.
That's right. Then with getting fucked and drinking your ass off, like it's you're never the next day. Like I mean, maximum you're going to be like, we had a lot of fun. I mean, it's probably always fun, but you're feeling so shitty. That you're like, oh, how am I still doing this to myself? Like, I thought this was over. You know, this is the eighth time I'm going to stop, like, getting smash faced on a Tuesday.
But listen.
This is the eighth time I'm saying that's
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But here's the difference between you're just feeling guilty for no reason.
Yeah.
And you're feeling something else, which is not guilt, but it leads you to change your life.
Yeah.
And talking specifically about drinking, since this is the example that you set.
Right.
Imagine you're sitting by yourself and you drink a bottle of whiskey. You finish a complete bottle of whiskey by yourself. You're gonna wake up fucked.
True.
Right? And you're gonna suffer at work. And you know, but so what? You got shit faced. You know,
I love it.
Really, if you really scratch beneath the surface, why are you feeling guilty?
I mean, largely because I feel like shit. You know, aside of anything else.
Yes, but
like,
but that's you're in pain.
Yeah.
From the hangover, your body's suffering. You fucked it.
Yeah.
But that's pain. What you're experiencing is guilt.
Yeah.
That's the emotional home that you're living in at that moment.
Yeah, I'll tell you. So here,
right? Am I
100%? So I'll give you a bit different example. Okay, margin trading.
No, but wait.
That's the one. Okay, we're going. Yeah, sure.
Sorry, but I said two things. Sure. You know, the first one is you, but the second one is the one that can potentially change your life.
Yeah,
is that you got drunk and you assaulted someone. You said something to your parents on the phone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You made a mistake that you shouldn't have made. Something very impulsive, or you had an experience of rage.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, these are the
and you you broke stuff and you said things.
You hurt people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. This is something that is a problem. Yeah, right?
Right.
And this is. Then it's no longer a vice; it's an escape.
Sure, yeah.
Right.
But guilt in its purest sober form. And I hear what you're saying, right? Like the fact that you are constantly wondering, like judgment, right? So you know, judgment. Most people who are judgmental on others are equally judgmental on themselves. There are hypocrites that are going to be judging others with a different lens than themselves, or find a different rationale that lets them get away with the exact same shit that they judge other people with, right? Intellectual dishonesty, and we've all done it at one point, and you know, it's hard to see it, and it's like it's almost like talking to asking a deaf person why they can't hear the music, you know, like, like they're so. The crackling of the ice for your water and cucumber.
Kasma Ayaz.
I was going to give this whiskey a promotion, to be honest. I think I should, because it's like a one-of-a-kind 13-year-old single malt, Craigellachie. I had to YouTube how to pronounce that, by the way, just in case I decide to cover it on the episode. So Craigellachie, they use worm tubs as a way of distilling By the way, how easily my ADD can hit, and I'm suddenly talking about whiskey. What were we talking about? We were talking. Wait, hold on. We were talking before the whiskey happened. We were talking about. Remind me. Do you have any idea?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I'm gonna wait for you on that one. Inspect the back label.
Now I lost my train of thoughts.
Yeah. But so this is okay. So here's one thing. Okay, if, I don't know what we were talking about. We'll come back to it. But I want to ask you another question. Okay, you used to play a lot of music when you were in high school, and we played together. You remember how you and I played? Was it the Winds of Change? Was it Winds of Change?
No, I flipped a coin with
Kareem Zidane. He ended up playing Kareem. Right. But you, I have to say, and I was hoping to say that. Give a shout out to Odyssey, your band in high school. You, Ayman Daher, Tamer Gargour, Laith Khoury, Walid Sukkar. Did I get you guys all? Yeah. Right? Best fucking high school band, in my opinion. And I've seen movies about high school bands, and I've seen high school bands and heard them. Underrated Absolutely. High school band. And I really want you to go ahead, for anybody that's listening to this, Metallica fan, or any sort of heavy metal fan, you know, Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath, if you're into this, you should totally. Where can they? Can this? You know? Can this music be found somewhere online at this point?
I think I wish that I could say yes, but there's a couple of songs on YouTube.
That's it.
Yeah. All right. You can leave a link.
I'm gonna leave a link, and I also would like you to really find a way to upload all that album, because I think it's one of those things that you know you might like be a Picasso, like die 20 years from now and. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then like 20 years, like it's 2080 and like, you know, you guys are famous and like there are LPs being made and shit. Like, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. This is one of the things that I actually felt, because we were talking about guilt.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, okay, thank you.
Right? So.
Yeah, go on, sir. I'm glad you got it. Sorry. I'm so happy we figured out what it was.
It's always going to come back because this is, we were the best high school band that you've seen, so you claim, right? And I think that
truthfully, by the way, not
true. I think if you hear the music structurally, this is the making of a young band that's going to do something.
Right.
Right? Like, I followed a lot of bands' stories, you know, famous rock artists and stuff, and they all start young, and they train a lot. But then we had to stop it, because we had to go to university, عبال التخريج, عبال I don't know what,
right.
And then get married, make money. I wanted to be, you know? I'm not saying that we all grew up to be fuckers.
Yeah.
You know, or like, you know, deadbeats. You know, Laith is a neurosurgeon in North Carolina.
That's fucking amazing.
He operates on brains.
Yeah.
And he's the lead surgeon. He's not like the comparse in the background.
Yeah. Do you think he plays like Metallica in the background?
He does.
Oh, that's fucking amazing.
He told me that. So he loves it. But this is another side of him.
That's amazing, by the way.
His brain is so technical. That's what enabled him to play the solos,
right? Yeah,
like geniusly, and create music that is at par with Metallica, for example, or more complicated bands like Dream Theater.
Yeah,
is that his brain is so analytical? So he's great in the operating room, operating under such tight spaces, like the guitar fret, for example. And that's that. I believe that he is living authentically.
Sure.
And he's my band member,
right?
You know, Odyssey band member. Yeah. You know, high school, the best high school How band cool you've ever
just,
seen.
Just saying that in your mouth, man. It sounds cool. Like
it's amazing. But then you leave it and you never come back to it. I'm a drummer.
Yeah.
Right? I play the drums. So after graduation until 2 years ago, I did not own a drum set in Dubai in my apartment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That means that you're not at all in touch with a side of you that's so important. It's not like it wasn't just a high school band.
But this is the thing about like Laith Khoury, right? So when he, first of all, cast Laith, like cheers for Laith, because like what a, like,
yeah.
How many of our friends do you know
who are
brain surgeons? and who are like, you know, this is one friend I'm proud to say, like, you know, this guy, I also studied medicine for a semester, so I know, thank you, Habibi. So I know exactly what kind of, you know, hustle and discipline and you know, tenacity it takes to become a doctor, and he's a brain surgeon, not just like... But I want to mention what about this thing that... so what I want to say is what makes it particularly commendable and what you're saying, living his genuine life, is that he's optimizing two things. The skill and the challenge are both high. In fact, there's like this framework called the flow model.
The flow, yeah. I've read that book.
I'm going to pull that
fascinating.
Up. So for anybody watching, I think he's where is he from? Yugoslavia, some Eastern European countries.
Mikhail.
He has a book on the flow.
But I remember specifically what you're talking about.
Here it is. Wait, I'm going to see if I can pull that up.
It's a graph between challenge and boredom.
Wait, let me see if I can get the framework. Yeah, there it is. It's just I can get that image.
Skill and challenge.
Skill and challenge.
Your skill has to meet the challenge. If your skill over exceeds your challenge, you get boredom.
Yeah. So skill level, low, high. So you're good at something or you're bad at it. Challenge level, how hard and easy it is for you, right? So if you're doing something that you're good at, if imagine you're just like naturally good at music or painting or numbers, and you're doing, and so that's a high skill. And the challenge level is that you're doing something that you haven't done before. It's harder than anything you've done before. It's the first time you're doing this level. It's like the God mode, you know? Then you're in the state of flow. So think, for example, in like the case of Leith, right? If he's good with his fingers or his eye-hand coordination or whatever it might require him to play the guitar solos and also to operate on brains, that's a skill he's just good at for whatever reason. He might be predisposed to this fun way or another, physically, mentally, or just like, you know, he's developed that skill, but he's good at it. But now his life, there are patients' lives at risk. That's the highest challenge possible, right? So, and by the way, I don't know how happy he is with his career, but let's assume he is and he's in flow. But that's why, because the skill is high and the challenge is high.
Yeah.
And I
absolutely, yes.
You know what I mean? And like a lot of times you're good at something, and that's what I was trying to talk about with this whole imposter syndrome thing, is that what if you're good at something, you're so good, but you haven't had a higher challenge because you've achieved it all. You've made all the money. Won the Oscar 20 times or whatever the fuck. I don't know. Some artists, like they have too many awards. Like they're nothing. The challenge is the same. Like I'm gonna get nominated again. Fuck it.
Yeah. Yazan, this is when you abdicate the throne.
Yeah.
And it happened in recent history in the most uptight monarchy that ever existed in human life.
Yeah,
the British Empire.
Oh, okay.
You know, they abdicated the throne because they had it all, but they felt like it wasn't challenging, or they didn't have the skill for it, or they wanted something completely different.
Yeah.
So they abdicate the throne. So this is a lot of people who succeed in business, they leave it and they go somewhere else. And usually, you know, you hear stories about, you know, the ex-CEO of GM in the 1960s that basically became a philanthropist or built a hotel in Africa and just chilled on the beach because he values nature. You know, the philanthropist guy decided to give away all his money because he wants to just make a difference, you know, and he's involved in his philanthropy. It's not just signing paychecks. That's just for tax purposes.
yeah.
You know, come on, who are we kidding? Mark Zuckerberg, fuck off.
Exactly. You know? But so philanthropy, I'm so glad you brought that up. Okay.
I love how we're on Facebook and I'm just, you know, telling Mark Zuckerberg to fuck off.
You wouldn't be the first, man. Like, this guy gets so much shit on Facebook. It's.
But everybody, you know, even Bill Gates,
I think Zuckerberg.
Philanthropy is a new trend. It's not right.
But so, let me ask you right off the bat. Do you think there's enough philanthropy happening? Because, like, you know, I don't think there is. Obviously, so okay. Let me take a step back and explain to you why I have a problem with philanthropy. It's supposed to be on a selfish level, what you should do if you can do it, and yet it's not enough. Take somebody who is extremely rich. Like, if you have $100 billion in your bank account, and you know you like you've there's no pleasure that you haven't experienced in life yet. Like you can't be 100 billion or let's talk about like there is at least a couple of 100,000 people out there, I don't know, who have $10 billion, $5 billion, $1 billion, right? There's at least a couple of thousand, if not a couple of million people with $1 billion or more. How are you at this point not all into all in into philanthropy? Like there's no house, island, food, type of pleasure in life that you haven't experienced, and that you don't need to, and that you can still experience with $1 billion in your bank account. But anything over $1 billion, you know, as my friend Yazan Barghouti would say, you should give these people a certificate. You know, congratulations, you've made the $2 billion plus kind of like club. Here's a certificate, you've made it. You know, now we take all your wealth and you're done. Like there's no point that you should have, there's absolutely no reason why anybody should have over $1 billion, $1 billion in today's economy and how things, how much things cost. Like $1 billion is $1 billion. It's safe for the next 60, 70 years. So anybody who's 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 billion, $7 billion rich, how are they not naturally getting the need to become philanthropic and give away all that money, not just like immediately donate it, but like do something with it, right? Like spend your life spending that money in a way that is actually going to be good for people. And nobody gets that. Like very few people get a bit of philanthropy and they start to like, you know, 5-10% of their wealth and the rest of it when they die. The rest of it when they die. This is like the funny part, right? Because like they need it as long as they're alive, just in the bank account making like interest or in a bond or like an... But they're only like spending like a fraction of it while other people are dying. So how is it that we are not naturally getting in, like, you know, when they talk about, when you talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the top part, the pinnacle of that pyramid is self-actualization. And one big format of that is philanthropy and doing, you know, helping people around you. And yet I don't feel like rich people are doing enough of that, and it's not coming to them naturally. And I don't know why, because you can become famous for becoming a philanthropist, if let's say this is a currency for doing shit, is that you need to be recognized. You will be, and I think you'll be applauded as the savior of humanity in one way or another. And yet people don't do it. So what's, like, have you ever thought about that? Like, why is there no natural drive to kind of like race towards philanthropy? Like, it feels like on a selfish level, you should become more eager to become a philanthropist. Like, it feels like that, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I can say is that being as rich as Bill Gates, or as rich as having $100 million, or even a fraction of that, is not normal.
Right.
It's not, we think it's the norm, but actually the 99% of the population is not there.
Sure. The 1%, right?
Yeah. So in order to get to that level of 100 million,
1 billion,
10 million even, you know?
Let's talk about 10 million may be like the right amount of wealth. I'm not saying this is it, but let's just, for the sake of example, 1 billion and more. You know how many people are $1 billion dollar rich? Like, no, there's a lot of 1 billion.
Yeah, yeah, but even on that level, you know, because it's not normal. It's not normal.
No, it's not.
So it means that in order to obtain that, to that level, you need to do something extraordinary, right? Extraordinary meaning extraordinary, which is out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Either you steal it, you cheat it, you work your ass off, you fuck over people, you spend sleepless nights, whatever.
Very few are fairly making that kind of work.
Yeah. So they're doing something extraordinary, which is pushing themselves outside of that, you know, for a reason or two, you know, greed or
luck,
they're trying to prove something, ego, whatever it is.
You were born into an area with a lot of oil, you know, type people.
Yeah.
That's there too.
And the first thing that comes to your mind, and by the first thing, I mean within the first decade or two or three of you accumulating that wealth, the first thing that your drive is definitely not because I want one day, inshallah, to become a philanthropist and cut ribbons and throw benefits and cut checks, you know? You don't think about that. So the philanthropy part of things is something that comes in later on in life when you've had it all.
That was like I was supposed to bring the volume down, but I just abruptly paused it. All right. I feel so much better. I think I can go on for another hour. Ironically speaking, should we wrap it up? I don't know. I mean, like, I'm.
Yeah, I think we can.
Okay. But like, this was like smack in the middle of you telling, you were about to tell a.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe just.
Yeah, I mean, my takeaway from this conversation is that we ignore the great divine details in us, and we live our day-to-day lives almost like zombies, regardless of our circumstances, regardless of our financial situation, regardless of our family matters. There's a micro decision on every level that you can take to make your life or the lives of your family or your children or the people you work for incrementally better. You know, and it's not a competition with anybody, you know. It's just the way it is,
right?
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know. To close, I think we can I can tell you a quote by Alan Watts, is that we take so seriously what the gods made for fun. This is a game at the end of the day. Everything, life is a game. You go out every day and you play.
Yeah.
If you can take it in that way, you know, if you can, instead of looking at your spouse, you know, your wife, your husband, your girlfriend, whatever, in the face and tell her, instead of telling her, let's get over with this dinner that we have to go to with your family or with my in-laws, you look at her and you say, I can't wait to go out with you tonight and play. I can't wait to play with you.
Yeah. That, it's a game.
You know, then the dinner is going to become playful and funny, and it becomes like a game. How can you embrace life a bit more? Yeah. Nothing is so serious.
It's so true, man.
You know,
yeah.
That's the beauty of living. That is the art of living, really.
Yeah.
When you really understand that there's, you know, there isn't that some sort of paternal, divine judge judging you every day, good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, the guy doesn't give a fuck about you. You know what I mean? That's actually a lot of the non-monotheistic religions. Their gods are just dancing all the time. They're happy.
Separated,
they're doing their thing.
Yeah,
they're just gods. They're elevated.
Yeah,
you know. So if you can take it in that way,
yeah,
then
you have less control over things.
You're liberated. Yeah, you're detached.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
that's the takeaway.
It's a big one. I mean, if half of us can actually accept that they can't control the outcome to the extent that they can, and just like live freely and flow freely, you know, if nothing else, we'd be less anxious, you know, which in and of itself is a winning. Where you end up is it doesn't matter, as long as in the present moment you're less anxious. Where you end up almost doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I think this has been a 2-hour stream. So
thank you,
Habibi. Thank you for coming. I have to say this, you know, with as much as I've loved all the other episodes that I've done, this format, being with you, talking to you, man, it's always been a pleasure. We've had days and nights of not sleeping and having conversations end to end. So I've been
doing a lot more than that too. But it's all good.
So excited, super excited to have you on. I'm glad I did finally. I hope it's not the last time I'm going to have you on the show. Cheers, Habibi.
Thank you so much.
Years of friendship, Habib Elman.
Thank you. And you know, it's not your typical, this is what I'm doing in my life in Dubai, and this is how I'm you know, making my money, or this is how I keep my body fit. No, it's
clearly not.
something about the soul, you know. It's just a conversation about the soul, really. Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about at the end.
But, and for me, ultimately, I started this podcast, and just to wrap up real quick, is because I enjoy having conversations with people at a level that it's not common to have. You know, you and I have always had really interesting chats. And I think when it comes down to how you spend your life, is that you should engage in some form of like thought experiments and in thought exchange with people, your partner, your friends, your parents, because what else are you going to do if not just like observe what's around you and analyze it and then do something about it in one way or another? And like, it's rare to have like cool thought partners. So I'm glad to have you on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. And just one last thing to the readers, to the listeners, read.
Yeah.
Read.
Yeah.
And less TV and social media. That's indeed really important.
Habib Rabi Allah, to the next one. We thank everyone for watching. Peace.